Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
The Saturday morning meeting was always kicked off with a Walmart cheer, and Sam Walton himself would lead the Walmart cheer. And you have to picture this. You got 500 people on Saturday morning, 7 o'clock, who are all enthusiastically cheering at the top of their lungs their company cheer. And I don't know how many other companies could pull that off.
Was it a long company cheer?
Well, the Walmart cheer is, give me a W, give me an A, give me an L, give me a squiggly, give me an M-A-R-T. What's that spell, Walmart? What's that spell, Walmart? Who's number one? And 500 people would call back the customer.
Wow. Hi, this is Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Walmart is the world's largest retailer, and I've secured an exclusive interview with one of the foremost experts on Walmart. His name is Michael. Michael is an international speaker, author, and writer. He's worked in Bentonville, Arkansas for Walmart as the director of people for the headquarters office, where he worked daily with Sam Walton. Previously to Walmart, he worked for PepsiCo's Frito-Lay division in the sales organization and headquarters staff assignments. He has experience as a turnaround specialist who's participated in several business turnarounds, has appeared on CNN, CNBC, FN, CBS, National Radio, Bloomberg TV. He is considered the authority on Walmart. The giant retailer's own public relation department has referred Bird Dog to interviewers who are interested in gaining insight into this massive company. He recently completed his second book entitled The 10 Rules of Sam Walton, Success Secrets from Remarkable Results. This two-hour interview is going to give you an edge over your competition to show you ways to understand Walmart, to give you a competitive advantage on pricing strategies and marketing strategies in selling your product into Walmart. I hope you enjoy it. We've got a lot to listen to. Let's get going. Hey, Michael, it's Mike Senoff here.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Terrific.
Here's what I did. I drew a picture on a white piece of paper that's sitting in front of me. It's a face, and they've kind of got like Chinese-looking eyes, and he's got tears running down his face, and it says, help me sell my product to Walmart. And I want to keep looking at that picture as I talk, because I want to keep that manufacturer or that inventor or that distributor in other countries other than the U.S. in mind, because I know it is their dream to get their products or their services or their widgets into large mass retailers. Walmart would be an ideal one, probably in many people's minds, probably a dream of all these people to get their product into Walmart. If they could supply Walmart, the world's largest retailer, they could become rich. Now, I know you may not know all the specifics of how to do that, but if they could have some intelligence, some inside information from an insider like yourself, it may give them some tips and some things to think about, whether they even want to attempt this, whether it's possible. And so during our interview today, I'd like to get some of that intelligence from you, because you are an insider with Walmart in many aspects. So I figured, what better person to talk to than you? So why don't you tell me, where are you from and what's your background and how did you end up working with Walmart, Michael?
Well, when I was living in Texas, I was working for PepsiCo, one of Walmart's suppliers, and I was working for the Frito-Lay division. And I was actually working out of Plano, Texas, which is in the North Dallas suburbs. And I got a call one day that Walmart was looking for a director of people for their home office in the Ozark Mountains up in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Okay, what's a director of people?
Well, people is what Walmart refers to their human resources department as. HR is people at Walmart. And Sam didn't like the term human resources. He preferred to refer to people as people. And so I was working at Frito-Lay at the time in the headquarters as a group manager of human resources, working with finance and IT professionals in Plano, Texas.
For anyone who doesn't understand what human resources is, just in a nutshell, what is the human resources department of a large company like that? What's their responsibility?
Well, in a big company like Walmart, human resources is really everything related to people. It's compensation, it's benefits, it's training and development, it's recruiting, orientation, college relations, human resource information systems, all of the personnel files and everything that is the history of an employee working for a company. It could be pre-employment screening programs, including drug screening programs, hiring of temporary services for temporary laborers. In some companies, human resources encompasses payroll. So it's all of the areas that affect the people of an organization.
So that's a pretty huge position. And you had heard that Walmart in the corporate office was looking for a director of that?
That's right. And so what I decided to do, I was really happy in the North Dallas suburbs. I went up to interview for the job. And to be honest with you, I went up with the idea that I was more flattered by the chance to interview with Walmart than I was actually serious about taking the job if it was offered.
Did you prepare for the interview somewhat?
Yeah, I did. I did some research on the company. Frito-Lay, one of the largest suppliers to Walmart, period. One of the most successful suppliers to Walmart. And I guess the measurement of success is inventory turn. Snack foods, potato chips in particular, have a very, what we call, high-velocity products. They blow off the shelves. Everybody buys snack food regularly. And so what was happening was they liked the idea of getting somebody from a supplier like Frito-Lay to work in the Walmart headquarters because they really wanted to pick my brain and learn about PepsiCo.
So you flew down there, and were there other people waiting in line for the interview while you were there?
The interview was actually on a Saturday morning, so I flew in on Friday night because the Walmart executives all work on Saturdays. And at 7 o'clock, they picked me up at the Quality Inn Hotel there in Bentonville, and I went into the offices and I interviewed with several of the key executives, the chief merchandising officer, the chief people officer, which is human resources, the chief operating officer, and the head of real estate of all things. And at the end of my interview with the COO, Sam Walton came walking into the interview and had already read my resume and was prepared to interview me.
How old were you at that time?
I guess I was 38 years old.
So Sam came walking in. Is the first time you ever laid eyes on him?
First time I ever laid eyes on him.
How old was he at that time?
He had to be, at that time, about 70.
Were you freaking out when he came in?
Oh, yeah. It was the most amazing thing. I'll tell you the story. I was sitting facing the COO, and we were in the middle of an interview question, and all of a sudden I noticed he looked over my shoulder into the doorway. So naturally, I followed his glance back, and standing in the door was this old man on Saturday morning wearing coveralls. And for just a moment, I thought it was the janitor coming in to pick up the trash. I knew a split second later, this is Sam Walton. He walks in, the COO introduces me using this eloquent southern accent. He says, Mr. Sam, this is Mike Birdall. And Sam looked at me with the strangest look on his face, and he says, Bird Dog? B-I-R-D-D-A-W-G, Bird Dog. And I didn't know whether that was a good thing or a bad thing to be referred to as Bird Dog by Sam Walton, but as it turns out, Sam was a prolific bird hunter and owned a pack of hunting dogs. So in that moment, I was instantaneously endeared to the most successful merchant in the history of the world.
Did he ask you some questions when he came in?
Yeah, he did. And one question in particular really caught me by surprise and really is indicative of his style of interviewing, because Sam used interviews as an opportunity to learn. And he said, Bird Dog, Frito-Lay, now there's a company I have the greatest respect for. What do you think is the key to their store-door delivery systems? And I'll never forget, at that moment, he gave me a question that I knew the answer to, and I proceeded to tell him all the inside secrets of Frito-Lay's store-door delivery system.
Wow.
Information that he could use to leverage Frito-Lay in negotiations.
Did you feel kind of weird about doing that?
You know, at the time when he asked the question, it seemed to me, the way it was positioned, it was a harmless question. Little did I know that it was actually divulging trade secrets, potentially, of Frito-Lay.
How long did your answer last with him?
I told them as much as I could tell them about the keys to the success of the store-to-door delivery system and everything I could tell them about the different channels of sales that Frito-Lay uses, because they have five different sales channels. A lot of people don't know that, and I don't think Sam Walton knew that. And so I was able to explain to him the different sales organizations they have in Frito-Lay, and I probably spent 15 minutes telling him all about Frito-Lay's organization and how it worked, and I'm sure somewhere in there he was looking for opportunities to potentially negotiate lower prices or ways to coach Frito-Lay to lower their expenses, in turn could lower the prices on their product.
So what did he say to you after that?
The interview was interesting. He talked about my business life, but he also talked about my family and the things that were important to me. And the way I remember the interview, I did most of the talking. He had a notepad on the desk, and he took notes. And he was known for that. He was a tremendous active listener. And so he would take down things that I had said, and he had a tremendous memory. And I think that part of that memory was the fact that he took good notes and he referred back to them in the future. And later on, when I met him in the hallway after I came to the company, I swear to you, he remembered me. In a company that had as many employees as Walmart has and as large a headquarters, he remembered me the first time he saw me, which I thought was incredible, having come from PepsiCo, where you'd see people in the hallways all the time and you didn't know who they were.
All right, so you finished the interview, and he left, and did you continue on with the other people?
Well, it turned out that the interview with Sam Walton was the last one. And what had happened, like many companies, they had screened me, and had I not passed the muster, if you will, they would have knocked me out. I never would have met Sam Walton that day. But they pre-qualified me, and they then let Mr. Walton know that I was a qualified candidate. And honestly, I think they used him like a trump card to close the deal. Because once you met Sam Walton, you were so enamored with the man and his personality and his leadership and the legacy of Sam Walton that you wanted to work around him. So when I left town that day, I remember thinking, I hope I get the offer now. And when I had come up earlier in the day, I was thinking, I'm up here, I'm flattered by the chance to interview. I'm not sure I want to move to the middle of the Ozark Mountains. I got back to Dallas, told my wife that it was a tremendous opportunity and that I would be working directly with Sam Walton, and we were just hoping that we would get the job offer, which we did, and we accepted, and we moved up to Northwest Arkansas.
How long was it after you met him that the job was offered to you?
It was within the next week. It was very quick.
So now you have this new job, and you are the director of people for the entire Walmart organization?
Well, I had the headquarters, which was Northwest Arkansas, and it was 4,000 what they called associates. They didn't call their employees employees. They called the employees associates, or business partners. I ran the support team for the headquarters as a director of people, and I supported all the headquarters functions that supported the stores. So I had a variety of departments. I had college relations, drug screening, government programs, training and development, compensation, benefits, data entry for the human resource information system. I had the staffing functions for the headquarters, but all of the functions to support the 4,000 in the headquarters.
Okay, so when you started the job there, what kind of differences did you see working for the Walmart organization compared to when you were with Frito-Lay? Was it a shock to you, and is this where your eyes really started to open at how they operated as a company?
Yeah, it was really a culture shock. When I came into the organization, I was the only person that was in my department that had been hired from outside the company from another organization. Everybody else was homegrown. Many of them had come out of store positions. They had been promoted into the home office from working in stores because they valued store experience. Most of the people on the headquarters staff at that time were, for example, non-degreed. And to compare and contrast PepsiCo with Walmart, at PepsiCo, if you had an open position, you were interviewing candidates that had 5 to 7 years of prerequisite experience, and what we said, they had sparks coming out of their you-know-what. At Walmart, they promoted people basically that had a good attitude and a high degree of interest without prerequisite experience. Many of the people that worked in that headquarters were hired off the farms in Northwest Arkansas, from as far away as Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, and in Northwest Arkansas, and they went to work there with a tremendous work ethic and great attitude. And so Sam Walton hired for attitude, and he taught people the skills they needed to do their jobs. I never believed that that would work. if you'd asked me that question when I was at PepsiCo, I'd say, no, you've got to have all this experience to be successful in any role. Well, the fact is you don't, and Walmart proves it every day, and you pay a premium for someone with 5 to 7 years of experience, and at Walmart, when you promote somebody, what they call picking them green, they promote somebody without prerequisite experience. They had a term called picking them green. When you pick them green, you don't pay a premium in the form of wages. And so the cost of labor at Walmart's headquarters was much lower than what I saw when I was working at PepsiCo.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Where do you think Sam Walton's philosophy on this keeping costs to the bare minimum came from? Did it start with him as a kid about saving money, or how was he so focused, and how did that spread to the entire Walmart USP, low prices? Where was the genesis of all that, do you know?
As I said, when I first met him, he was 70 years old, so he had grown up and lived through the Depression years. And I think that those times really shaped who he was in a leadership position at Walmart. He understood how difficult it was to make money, and one of the ways to save money is not to spend it, and that's what he would do. He was cheap as the day is long, and it was self-professed. He would tell people with pride that cheap is chic at Walmart, and all the associates were tight with the buck. The associates I worked around, as if they were writing the check out of their personal bank accounts. They didn't care what the market price was for any given product. What they wanted was the Walmart price, which was always much lower than the advertised market price for goods, products, and services.
You had mentioned that the green people you were working with, even in all the management in that organization, how was it working with them? Did you view yourself as a different type of person to the people you were working with, or did you get along good?
The people that work there are team players. And what you have to be careful of working for Walmart is egotistical prima donna type personalities are destined to fail at Walmart. Walmart values team success more than individual success. So what you find yourself doing is you find yourself becoming a better team player when you work for Walmart than you've ever been before. They also value what they termed at PepsiCo, that people have form and they have substance. And at PepsiCo, you could get ahead on form with limited substance. At Walmart, you were evaluated on substance. You had to deliver. You couldn't talk a good game. You had to play a good game. And you had to make contributions each and every day as a member of a team. And leaders who had the ability to give credit to the team for success of the team did better than those that tried to take credit for themselves. So there was a bit of a culture shock, because it's completely contrary to what at PepsiCo, you had lone wolf mentality where everybody was out seeking recognition for themselves to move their own career ahead. In Bentonville, Arkansas, Sam's first Ben Franklin store was opened in the square. And years later, when he had opened a number of Walmart stores, he bought that property and turned it into the Walmart Museum. Once the company became successful, there were visitors that would come to the Bentonville home office for Walmart to visit, because it was sort of a homey company and a friendly company, and Sam Walton treated his customers like neighbors or friends. So people would just stop by to visit at the home office. So what he did is he created an alternative for visitors that were coming to Bentonville to visit Walmart. He created this museum, which gave them a place that they could go so they wouldn't have to turn them away at the home office. Visitors would arrive in the square in Bentonville, and the facade on the store is the old Ben Franklin store that he had, but inside it's a museum. And the museum includes his office the way it was the day that he died. It has his old pickup truck, and it's got lots of memorabilia from the early days of Walmart and some from Ben Franklin. They get a lot of visitors to the Walmart Museum. The Walmart Museum, they have a glass case, and in the glass case are examples of product returns that Sam Walton accepted in the early days of the company. And in the case, as an example, is an old thermos bottle. And this thermos bottle was returned to one of his stores by a customer, and they gave the customer a refund based on what the customer told them the thermos was worth. But as it turned out, this particular thermos was no longer manufactured and had been sold by another retailer and gone out of production before the first Walmart store was ever opened. So Sam took a return for a product that he never sold. In the case also is an old golf club that had been clearly wrapped around a tree. It was bent in half. And in the case, it says the customer brought the golf club back and Sam promptly gave him a refund.
Did he ever talk about this philosophy on refunds, even though it's evident, and does that philosophy stand even today?
Well, Sam's philosophy on refunds was this. He was the first to put his customer service desk in the front of his retail stores. If you think back and you remember, all of the customer service desks for retailers were located as far back in the corner of the store as they could possibly be located, so the customers going through the registers couldn't see disgruntled customers being handled back in the customer service area. So what Sam Walton said was, I want my customers coming through the registers to see how a disgruntled customer is handled when they make a product return. And Mr. Sam had a saying. He would ask the customer, what would you like us to do? And then whatever they said, if they wanted their money back or they wanted a new product, he would just do it. And that's what he would teach all of the Walmart associates. Ask the customer the question, what would you like us to do? And whatever they say, just do it. And that was his response to 100% satisfied customers. There's a story of a customer that brought a coffee maker back to the Walmart store to return it, and when they looked it up in what they call their item file, they couldn't find it. It turned out that this astute department manager looked in a flyer that they had seen from Kmart, and this particular coffee maker was featured in a Kmart flyer. They told the customer that this was not a Walmart item, that it had been purchased at a Kmart, and the customer was about to leave the store, and they said, well, wait a second. We are going to go ahead and refund you the money for this coffee maker in hopes that in the future, when you buy a coffee maker, you'll buy it at Walmart.
That's great customer service.
Absolutely.
Tell me about your Saturday meetings. This is probably something new to you, correct?
When I first went to work for Walmart, they said, are you willing to work on Saturdays? And I said, of course I am. I've worked Saturdays and evenings and whatever I had to work to get jobs done throughout my career. But I never had to work mandatory Saturdays 52 weeks a year. And the meetings start at 7 o'clock in the morning on Saturday morning. And when I would get there, I would get to the meeting at, say, 10 minutes to 7. And by 10 minutes to 7, I had to park 10 rows back in the parking lot because everyone else had arrived at 6:30 or 6 o'clock or 5:30 in the morning. It was unbelievable.
Right.
On Saturday morning, I'm having to walk through the parking lot past row after row after row of cars of people who had arrived earlier.
Where were the meetings held? In an auditorium?
They were held in the auditorium at the home office headquarters. There's a large auditorium that held 500 of the top leaders of the organization. And today they have closed circuit television that goes out to the departments on Saturday morning so that people can sit at their desks, because the company is so much larger. And the Saturday morning meeting was always kicked off with a Walmart cheer. And Sam Walton himself would lead the Walmart cheer. And you have to picture this. You got 500 people on Saturday morning, 7 o'clock, who are all enthusiastically cheering at the top of their lungs their company cheer. And I don't know how many other companies could pull that off.
Was it a long company cheer?
Well, the Walmart cheer is, give me a W, give me an A, give me an L, give me a squiggly, give me an M, A, R, T. What's that spell, Walmart? What's that spell, Walmart? Who's number one? And 500 people would call back the customer.
Wow.
And that's the cheer. And everybody was focused on the customer.
Is that still happening today, every Saturday morning?
Still happens every Saturday morning today.
It's broadcast through closed-circuit TV all over the country, all over the world?
You know, now that you say that, it's broadcast through the home offices.
Oh, I see.
But I will tell you this. Walmart has satellite capability, and they have satellite capability to broadcast to all their stores across the country.
So how about the Walmarts here in San Diego? Are all the employees at a Saturday meeting?
No, in fact, they would intentionally not have them in the Saturday morning meeting because it's more of a leadership meeting. But the reason for the Saturday meeting is, in a nutshell, is this. Walmart is a centralized organization where all of the store operations VPs live and work out of Bentonville. But what they do, the divisionals go out on Monday morning and they fly out to their particular region of the country. And they don't come back until Thursday night. So they're in the market for that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, every week of the year, and then they come back Thursday night, and on Friday morning, they go into day-long meetings to talk about what they saw in the marketplace that particular week. So they talk about what the competitors are up to. They look at merchandising strategies of competitors. They look at problems out in the marketplace and get very specific about it. Could be a particular metropolitan area. It could be Denver, Colorado. And so you could go into specific discussions on specific stores where they're having problems. But what they do after this day of discussions of strategies and tactics, which is Friday, they then, on Saturday morning, talk about the findings from that week specifically with the top 500 leaders of the organization, and they talk about the strategies that they're going to implement in the coming week to address what they found.
So it seems like these vice presidents who went out were an extension of exactly what Sam did when he had his chain of Ben Franklin stores out there going into competitors, taking notes, because I remember listening to the story about Sam on the audio tapes. Is that what he was trying to do with these vice presidents, to get them out doing the same thing he did to build it successful in the early days? Looking for opportunities, looking for unexploited opportunities in merchandising and products and all of that. Is that correct?
Absolutely. What Sam would tell all of us to do is go out and talk to the associates and talk to the customers.
Now, who were the associates?
The associates are the employees of the company. Because if there was a particular department or a product, you could have one of two extremes. You could have a product that is blowing off the shelves in one particular store. You could go talk to the associates and find out, why is this particular product selling so well in this particular store in this particular market? And by finding out the reasoning behind that, you could then potentially implement a similar strategy across all the stores on Friday morning and say, hey, we're selling this product at 5 times the rate of normal sales in the organization. Here's what we're doing. If we were to merchandise a product the same way across the country, we could increase sales in a similar manner. On the other hand, you could have a product that's not selling at all, and you could ask the associates, what's going on with that product? Why isn't it selling? Because the people closest to the customer understand the products better than anybody else. On the other hand, they will also talk to customers and ask customers, what products would you like to see in the store that aren't here currently? What products do you like that are in the store right now that you want us to continue carrying? And so what the people at Walmart do better than almost anybody else is they put their finger on the pulse of the people in the organization, the customers, and the products.
What they're doing is they're doing their research. They're doing the cheapest form of research, and that's talking directly to the customers and the people who know exactly what's going on.
And they do it 52 weeks a year.
Now, let's look at Frito-Lay. Did they do that kind of research, or were they paying for high-end consulting and doing impact studies, expensive type of ineffective research?
Well, I think the consumer packaged goods company like Frito-Lay, with 5 different channels of sales, they had account sales, which were supermarkets. They had route sales, which were convenience stores. They had institutional sales, which were hospitals and military bases. They had the club market, which was the Sam's Clubs and the wholesale club type market. And the last market was the vending machine market, for the machines where you put money in and you get vend products. And so they had 5 different sales forces. So to begin with, and answer your question, what Walmart did is they simplified their business. What Frito-Lay did is they had a tendency to overly complicate their business. Instead of having a centralized organization like Walmart did, PepsiCo had a decentralized organization, and they were into micro-marketing. So what they would do is they would go into Alabama and try to compete with Golden Flake potato chips on a local basis, where Golden Flake, so to speak, owned that market. And they would try to come up with competitive strategies to compete in Alabama against Golden Flake specifically, and they come up with products that they would manufacture to cater to regional tastes of Golden Flake in Alabama. And so the Frito-Lay business, in my opinion, was overly complicated. However, having said that, Frito-Lay owned a 50% share of stomach in the snack food industry. So it was a big business, but it was much more complicated than the business of Walmart, and Sam Walton valued simplification. Picture this. It's Saturday morning. It's 7 o'clock, and at Walmart, they're about to hold their famous Saturday morning meeting. So you arrive first thing in the morning, and you go over to the coffee bar, which is really an honor bar, where they have coffee and donuts. And you get your coffee, and you get your donut, and there's a little box in front of the coffee machine where you put your money to pay for your coffee and donuts on Saturday morning. So there is no free coffee and donuts at Walmart. And that's how far the company would go to save a buck. And I will guarantee you if you counted the money in that honor box at the end of the morning, you would find that there is at least a dollar amount equal to all the purchases, and there's probably more money there than what products were purchased. That's the integrity and the honesty of the Walmart culture, and that's how far they would go to save money.
For more interviews like this, please go to hardtofindseminars.com.
How about when you worked there, were there any corporate events that they put on or picnics that were just real cheap?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't unusual for different celebrities on retainer. And where does Garth Brooks sell more of his tapes than any other store in the world?
Walmart. Right.
He was happy to take the trip to Walmart for free or at the expense of his record label to visit with the Walmart executives and the associates. But we used to have company picnics during the shareholders meeting that were the good old-fashioned hamburger and hot dog picnics, and we would have Wall Street types that would show up, and they would go to picnics. It might have been the only picnic that they would go to for the whole year, and all of the Walmart picnics were dry picnics. You would have lemonade, or you might have a Coke or a Pepsi, but there was no alcohol or beer served at any of the corporate functions. Alcohol at Walmart was a taboo. During the shareholders meeting for Walmart, there were company picnics all over Northwest Arkansas, and various groups would sponsor these picnics that were the traditional in the park at the picnic table with hot dogs and hamburgers.
So we all started this with the vice presidents going out, and then we were getting back to the actual meeting that you were in on Saturday morning. So you'd have all the regional vice presidents, and what was discussed in the meeting? What was the format of that Saturday morning meeting?
Well, they would actually have reports from the divisional vice presidents based on what they had seen in the market that previous week and what they had discussed all day on Friday, and they would each take somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 minutes to present what was going on in the marketplace. The goal was to get everybody that was in the room, the top 500 leaders, up to speed on what was going on in the market. Why did they do that? Sam Walton expected everyone who worked for Walmart to think like a merchant. I worked in the people division, but I was expected to have my finger on the pulse of product and customers. And in addition to reports from the divisional VPs, at the end of the store operations part of the meeting, Sam Walton would have merchandise buyers come in next. And each of the merchandise buyers for Walmart would present products to the top 500 people of the organization.
Are these products that they're looking at and considering carrying, or would they be presenting them for approval from the people in the audience, or what was the purpose of that?
Well, they were products that were being considered for the stores, and yes, they were asking the people in the audience to evaluate the products that they were presenting.
Based on what they've seen out there in the field.
Right. This is fascinating. Let's picture a buyer at Walmart, because a supercenter might have 125,000 distinctly different products. So a particular buyer might buy hundreds, if not thousands, of products for the store. And on this particular Saturday morning, they have to bring one product in that they're going to present, and there's a line of buyers, and as one finishes presenting, another starts.
How many do you think there were at a meeting?
Well, it wouldn't be all the buyers, but you might bring 15, 18, 20 buyers in, and they would each present a product to the people in attendance. And so picture a buyer that has a newfangled toaster. He brings his toaster in, and he's on the stage with Mr. Sam.
So Sam's up there the whole time?
The whole time.
Wow.
And he's standing in the middle of the stage. By the way, I called him Mr. Sam because everybody called him Mr. Sam out of respect for Sam Walton.
How was he dressed on that Saturday morning?
He could be in blue jeans and a flannel shirt. He could have his duck boots on for hunting. He could be in camouflage.
Did you ever see him dressed up in a coat and tie?
Yeah, I saw him that way also. More often than not through the week, he was in a coat and tie. But typically, it wasn't a suit. It would be a blazer and slacks.
Now, what was the dress code for you and everyone else there?
On Walmart, it was sort of khakis, a shirt and tie. On the Sam's Club side, if you walked into Sam's Club wearing a tie, they'd cut it off your neck.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was a wall in Sam's Club that had ties of clueless people who had walked in there with a tie on, and they had them all stapled up on a piece of plywood.
That's funny.
And that's the difference in culture.
All right, let's get back to the buyer presenting a toaster.
Picture this. There's 500 people watching this happen. So Mr. Sam says, "What do you got there?" And the buyer says, "I have a toaster." He says, "How many units are you proposing? What's the price point? When will it be in the stores? What's the margin?" And the buyer is proceeding to tell everyone in attendance all about this product. And then Mr. Sam would take that toaster and picture this. He'd hold it up over his head and walk across the stage and call out, "What do you think? What do you think?" And on some items, like this toaster, you might get a thumbs up or you could get a thumbs down. And if he got a thumbs down on that toaster, he'd take it back, hand it to the buyer, and say, sounds like you need to get you another product.
So any thumbs down, he'd reject it?
He'd reject it.
And were the people in the audience pretty forthright and honest?
Absolutely. If they liked it, they were just as excited as could be. There's no game playing. If they liked the product, they would say so. If they didn't like it, they would jeer.
Would they say why?
They might, but with the time constraints we had, the buyer had their chance to make the sale, and if they didn't make the sale, that was enough. The perception that it wasn't good enough was enough. So he would tell them to go back and get another product, and that's what they would do.
Okay, do you think something like that's still going on in different forms?
I do. And think about, what was the point of this exercise? It wasn't to teach the buyer how to buy.
It was to train the vice president how to be merchandisers.
And the top 500, the people from accounting, the people from HR, the people from real estate, the people from marketing, to teach us all of the connection between products and consumers. And so he was teaching us to be merchants.
So what did you learn? Did you learn a great deal about being merchants in those meetings?
Oh, absolutely. It gave you a feeling of connection with the stores, a connection that you didn't have at PepsiCo. When you were sitting in the headquarters of Frito-Lay in Plano, Texas, you just didn't have that connection with the customer who was purchasing the potato chips at retail. And you didn't have a good sense for what the route salespeople were thinking about the products that were coming into the distribution centers. We had a real connection with the stores, and we were told to travel to the stores, work in the stores, talk to the associates, and really understand our customers. The exercise you saw on that Saturday morning was designed to teach everyone else to be a merchant. They're buying hundreds, if not thousands, of other products all the time that there's no committee approval. They buy them, and what they used to say at Walmart is, you eat what you kill. And the buyers who bought those products were responsible for seeing that they were merchandised and would sell through. And the buyers at Walmart have the biggest buying responsibilities of any buyers in the world, simply because of the number of stores, which are somewhere in the neighborhood of 6,700 stores around the world today. And if someone was coming in to make that sale of a barbecue grill to a buyer in Bentonville, the first thing that you would see as we walked in the morning, by the way, you'd see this vendor in the parking lot with his socket set building the grill out in the parking lot to bring into the building to show to the buyer. The Walmart buying team does not go to the showroom, wherever that company is located, to look at their barbecue grills. You want to show a barbecue grill? You construct it out in the parking lot and you drag it into the building to show the buyer. I saw salespeople who were selling swing sets, building swing sets out in the parking lot, and the buyer would come out to the parking lot to see the swing set constructed, and they talk about it right on the spot there where it was constructed. Saw the apparel manufacturers coming in with apparel from New York, the New York apparel merchants. And we'd hear them when we were on airplanes sitting behind us complaining about having to come to Bentonville to make the sale, because every other buying team in the world goes to New York to make their purchases, not Walmart.
So anyone who wants to sell to the Walmart organization must come out to Bentonville even today?
That's the fact.
What about international? Do they have to fly here, or are there offices that they can present to?
Yeah, the international countries have buying offices in those countries where the setup is similar.
Okay. Michael, you're the author of two books, The 10 Rules of Sam Walton and What I Learned from Sam Walton. How do you feel the 10 rules Sam Walton followed while building Walmart allowed his company to overtake such retail giants like Kmart, Sears, Woolworth, Service Merchandise, and Montgomery Ward?
If you look at the 10 rules, and contrary to what you see in the news media today, 6 of Sam's 10 rules were about how to treat the people in your own organization. And in answer to your question, I think that probably more so than anything, the associates of Walmart deserve and are given much of the credit for the success of Walmart over the years and to this day. And Sam Walton developed people, he gave them responsibility beyond their expectations, and he believed in people, and they exceeded his expectations. And I think the army of Walmart associates, and there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.7 million Walmart associates today, are the key to the success of the organization, because retail is a people-intensive operation. And yes, Walmart has incredible technology. Yes, they have incredible logistics. But nothing gets done without the people. And that's what Sam figured out long ago. And through his profit-sharing programs and taking care of the folks in the organization, they did whatever it took to satisfy those customers. And to boil it all down, the key to the success of the organization is the people.
What are a couple of the rules that someone's going to see in your book, the 10 rules?
Well, rule number one is commit to achieving success and always be passionate. And that rule is designed for, if you look at it from the standpoint of a leader, to be committed to be successful. And it doesn't matter whether you're working for Walmart or if you're trying to head up a group of Boy Scouts. A leader has to be committed and they have to be passionate if they expect people to follow them. So if there was one person who was passionate, it was Sam Walton. He would eat, live, and breathe Walmart. He thought about merchandising products 24/7, 365. What Sam Walton thought about is what he became, the most successful merchant in the history of the world, and that was because of sheer commitment and passion. Some of the other rules. He believed in sharing success with those who have helped you to succeed. And what he did at the time the company went public back in 1970 is he put a profit-sharing program in place so that the associates of Walmart, right down to every hourly employee, could participate in the success of the organization. And there's stories all over Walmart of truck drivers and distribution center employees and store employees who are millionaires many times over from participation in stock programs, by the employee stock purchase program and the profit sharing program. They made millions because the Walmart stock has split 11 times. And so share success with those who've helped you.
What's another rule?
I think one of the really important ones is controlling expenses and saving your way to prosperity. Yeah, Walmart does a great job of buying products for the stores at the lowest possible prices, but the other hidden piece of their success is their ability to control expenses. People are really tight with a buck at Walmart. They do not waste money. They spend money the same way they would spend money if they were buying things for their own home. They do so many things to control expenses. Some of them are a little bit outrageous. The executives who travel, the president of the company, when he travels with the CFO of the company, they share a hotel room in a budget hotel. And how many Fortune 500 companies would you see people doing that? When Sam was alive, he didn't believe in having a corporate jet. He owned a fleet of propeller-driven aircraft, one that he flew himself, and when the executives of the company, the vice presidents, needed to go out to the stores, they would go out on these propeller-driven planes from Bentonville all the way to Florida, or from Bentonville all the way out to Phoenix. The thing was, he believed that it sends a message. On one hand, you're saying that we want to keep costs down, and then if you have a bunch of bigwigs flying around in corporate jets, it sends the wrong message.
Well, it also sends a message to the public. I mean, you've got a huge company promoting low prices, and he's living what he's practicing. He's practicing what he's preaching. He's not the bigwig wasting money. It's just inconsistent message, even to the public, in the media, too.
When Sam Walton flew on a commercial flight, he always flew coach. Picture a billionaire flying coach. You know, you've heard the story of Sam Walton who drove an old pickup truck, and he did. He lived in the same house that he lived in when he started the business, a home that any of us could have afforded. He didn't believe in having a showy lifestyle, and he wasn't real comfortable with being a billionaire.
You're listening to Michael Sinoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
And the family members at Walmart are worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 billion today.
How many kids did he have?
He had four kids and his wife, and they're the ones that inherited. And he got about $20 billion each.
Are the sons involved in the business?
Yeah, they are. Of course, Rob is the chairman of the board of the company, and so he's involved in the operation, but not day-to-day. Rob doesn't live in Bentonville any longer. He lives, I believe, in Colorado, but he's chairman of the board. Other family members are on the board also, but I wouldn't say that there's anybody involved in the direct day-to-day operation of the company.
Now, did Rob write the foreword for your book?
Yeah, that was very exciting. Getting his endorsement in the form of a foreword for the book meant so much to me because it said that the story I had told about the 10 rules was accurate. And when I first went to Walmart to present the manuscript to their corporate communications department, which is their PR department, they were suggesting Lee Scott, let the president of Walmart do the foreword. And I said, you can't do that. I said, if I wrote a book about your father, you can't have somebody else write the foreword about it. It's got to be the son. And so I convinced Rob Walton to read the manuscript, and he ended up writing the foreword for the book. And it has really meant a lot to me personally to have his endorsement.
Let's go back to your new job. How did your 10 rules that you were learning in the culture, did it have a strong implication on your role as the director of people at Walmart corporate headquarters? And how did they guide you personally during your tenure with the company?
Well, the rules that really made the biggest impact on me were swimming upstream, be different, and challenge the status quo. Sam Walton was a big believer in taking risks and trying new things. And it was okay to fail at Walmart. And I think that was one of the things I learned, that you can take a risk, and when you do take risks, you're going to make mistakes and you're going to fail. 8 out of 10 times, Sam Walton would tell you, when you take a risk, you fail. And I found that in my own life, I will try things now that I might not have tried years before out of concern that I would fail. But if you have the concern of failure, you'll probably never achieve great things. And so I take risks and I try to do things that others aren't doing. Sam would tell you, if everybody else is going this way, we're going to go that way. And I learned that lesson real well from him, and it's one that I use to this day. Controlling expenses, I already talked about that, but when controlling expenses, I recycle everything. I use the back side of every sheet of paper, as do everyone at Walmart. All the Walmart associates are trained to use the back side of every sheet of paper. And if you think about that, it theoretically cuts your paper cost by 50%. And when you have 1.7 million employees, that makes a difference in your cost when everybody's using paper every day. And so, very simple idea, I use it to this day in my business. Exceeding expectations of customers and others. I believe if you just meet the expectations of your customers, you're probably doing better than most of your competitors. So if you have a goal to exceed expectations, you basically own the market. And that's the goal that I have with my business, is to really exceed the expectations of my customers, to make a difference in their lives, and by doing so, I have repeat customers as a result.
You gave me a great example of educating the vice presidents and training them how to be merchants. What kind of programs did Walmart have in place to generate new ideas for within the company? I'm sure that he had all the employees submitting ideas for the betterment of the company. Can you think of any formalized way that this was done?
There's a couple of different programs, but let me talk about one specific to products. Because they had a program that was a, so to speak, suggestion box type program called Yes We Can Sam, which was designed for employees to submit ideas to improve any area of the operation. But they had a program that I thought was fascinating that was designed to improve products, and it was called VPI, Volume Producing Items. The Volume Producing Item program allowed associates to pick products in the store and merchandise those products on end caps in a big way to try to increase sales velocity. And what would happen is you had what Walmart referred to as intrapreneurs, an entrepreneur inside a company, an intrapreneur who could select a product, go to their supervisor and say, I want to promote this particular product because I believe we can increase the sales on it.
Now, are these buyers within a category?
No, these are hourly associates at store level. They could say, I want to sell more Colgate toothpaste than we've ever sold before, and I'm going to create an end cap with 4,000 tubes of Colgate on this end cap, and I'm going to sign it right, and we're going to blow them out the door. There was one example of an employee in a store in Alabama who took a catalog from one of the suppliers that he had seen and asked his store manager if he could order mountain bikes. And this is back at a time when mountain bikes didn't exist in Walmart stores. And the manager on a local level has some degree of buying authority. Not a lot, but they have some degree of buying authority. So this particular store manager approved the purchase of the first mountain bikes for his store in Alabama. They brought them on a local basis because there was a college campus there. It had the potential to be a good item. And this young man, who was at the time a college student himself, a part-time employee, brought these bikes in, built samples to put on the floor, and built a nice display. And they sold the heck out of high price comparatively to what Walmart was carrying at the time. High price mountain bikes, they sold them like hotcakes in this particular store. And they took the idea of this employee and they rewarded him for it. And across the entire chain at Walmart, they began to carry mountain bikes. And it was a result of an idea of one associate. Now, ideas are easy. It's the implementation that's tough. And a lot of times Mr. Sam would say, that's a great idea. Let's see you implement it. And if that person could implement it, he had a belief that if one can do it, all can do it. And that was the key at Walmart with simplifying things. You had to prove that one store could do it, or one department could do it, or one associate could implement it in a particular department. And if it could be done in one place, it could be done everywhere. And that's the simplification strategy of Walmart, and that's how they would take associate ideas and affect the bottom line.
How would they promote an idea like that from an employee? How was he rewarded?
What they would do is they actually had awards they would give for the volume-producing items, the most successful. They weren't just based on a perception that it was a nice merchandise display. It was hard numbers based on the number of units sold, inventory turn, margins, profitability. What they would do is they would have district-level contests between stores for volume-producing item to see who could come up with the best item. And what they would do is they would mine these great ideas like gold, and then Mr. Sam had the ability to just replicate them across the system using Saturday morning meetings. He could find an idea like this mountain bike idea during the week when the VP was in that particular store, and they told him about that bike example. He'd bring it back. On Friday, they'd talk about it, and Mr. Sam could have it implemented on Saturday across the chain.
So a new high-volume product could potentially be selling in every store.
Yep, and that's really true of Walmart. Even with products they buy from outside the company through normal channels, what they do is they test product first anyhow. A supplier that might be interested in bringing product into Walmart would often get a test of some limited number of stores. They might get a test of 50 stores to put their product into initially to prove a lot of different things, to prove that they have the ability to replenish product, to get it in there initially, to see if the customers are interested in buying it. And once the product is proven, then what they do is they ramp up and move it into more stores. But that's how they did it internally, and there were examples of this BPI program, which, by the way, has been in place for over 20 years. They do it all the time, and the associates are encouraged to come up with new ideas for better ways to merchandise and sell products.
So if I had a local product that I thought would have a chance in a Walmart store, I could conceivably approach a manager in my local store about it, right?
That's right. And you could probably start with the department manager that runs that department in the store. They could be the champion for that product within the store. It doesn't necessarily have to be the store manager who has the interest in that product. You could start at a assistant manager level or go to a department manager, because those department managers know the customers for their products better than anybody else in that store. So it's very possible for someone with a local product to make a sale on a local level.
Give me an example, Michael, of Sam Walton's operational excellence.
With so many employees or associates in the company, one of the most important parts of the culture is the focus on operational excellence. And how did they do that? Well, they had a program at Walmart called Hetkati. And Hetkati is a pseudo-American Indian word. And at Walmart, they had a Hetkati song and a Hetkati dance that they'd actually act out in the form of a ritual for the associates of the store. And picture a manager with a semicircle of employees in front of them and them going through the Hetkati song and dance. And in this ritual, they would drive the concept of Hetkati, which was an acronym which stood for High Expectations Are the Key to Everything. And they would focus everyone in the store on the concept that to set high expectations for everything that you do. And a great example of high expectations is their focus on quality in everything that Walmart does. They're trying to do it to the highest quality standard level that they possibly can, and they do it through their people.
This is the end of part one of Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com interview with Walmart expert. Please continue to part two.